getting farther away. With the little reservation I could muster, I tried to think of something to say, something polite and witty by way of declining.
Maybe I could just...
Maybe so,
she agreed. Miranda's hand tightened on mine. She led me under the ristra doorway and inside. Chapter 33. It was only the fear of meeting Milo Chavez if he came to work in the morning that got me home to 90 Queen Anne Street before dawn. I caught about 3 hours of sleep before Kelly Arguello's phone call woke me up again.
"Good God," she said, "what's that noise?"
I rubbed the crud out of my eyes and tried to identify any unusual sounds other than the grinding inside my skull.
"Oh, just Robert Johnson," I told her.
"Are you torturing him?"
Robert Johnson kept making his overworked wench motor noise.
I tried to wriggle my foot loose from his front claws. He rolled on his back so he could attack with all four. I rubbed his belly with my toes while he gave my ankle the meat hook treatment.
"Sort of," I said. "I'm late with breakfast."
"You must make a hell of a breakfast." I tried to get up from the futon. Mistake. I steadied myself on the ironing board, sat down again, and waited for the fuzzy black balloons to go away. I tried my best to make my brain work while Kelly started giving me the rundown on what she'd found so far about Les St. Pierre. Once again, she surprised me. In the world of government paperwork, you can't expect much out of 48 hours, but somehow Kelly manages. She'd already gotten all of Les's driver's information from DMV, body reports on the Mercedes convertible and the Seville that he'd left behind, his driver's record, previous applications, Allison St. Pierre's record. Kelly had written for the incident report on a DUI Les had received last year in Houston. That would take another week at least. She'd submitted a few tons of requests to the Social Security Administration and various state agencies looking for any recent papers issued for any of the names from Julie Kern's personnel files. We'd been a little too liberal in the weeding process, narrowing down the scope to the six most likely candidates for a new Les St. Pierre. But even with that many names, tracking paperwork was going to be a nightmare. Kelly planned on following up Monday morning.
"How'd you squeeze DMV so quickly?" I asked.
"No big deal. I told the guy at the desk I was working a grand jury subpoena for the state attorney's office, like that time in San Francisco you told me about. You're right. It works like a charm."
"I wasn't suggesting that as model behavior, Kelly."
"Hey, what? You want me to put the information back?"
I hesitated. "Trace Navarre, the moral example."
"They bought the state attorney line from you, huh?"
"Sure.
Purple hair and all."
She sighed. "Jesus, Trace, it's not like I wore a nose stud or anything. I can dress business. I look good in a blazer." I didn't argue the point.
Kelly went on to tell me about Les St. Pierre's parents' death certificates in Denton County, which had led her to a probate court settlement on their estate, which had in turn given her a list of real estate inherited by Les. He'd received the small family house in Denton and a vacation house on Medina Lake. Kelly had sent requests to Denton County and Avalon County for copies of the assessor's records on both properties.
"Medina Lake," I repeated. "Avalon County."
"That's what it says here. I'm skeptical about the place in Denton, but I'm pretty sure he's still got the lake property."
"Why?"
"I went to Parks and Wildlife. Les has a freshwater sailboat registered."
I whistled. "You're pushing for a bonus now."
A lot of paper chasers overlook Parks and Wildlife. I normally wouldn't have tried it myself so early in the process. Usually you start with the obvious and work your way toward the obscure. Fortunately, in this case, Kelly worked differently. Her procedure was dictated more by where all the government offices in Austin fell on her bus line. "It isn't a big boat," she told me. "A 25-footer. He didn't need to get it registered, but it looks like he did anyway."
I thought about Les's bedroom, about the labeled shoeboxes that filled his closet, even his illegal drugs and his scams on women all neatly categorized and filed away. Maybe the bastard had been a little too organized. Go on. He bought the boat at Plum Cove, Medina Lake. I made some calls, got an address for the dry dock space he's been renting. I found a pen wedged in the crack behind the ironing board / phone alcove and wrote down the information.
Good stuff.
Yeah, at least nobody else has asked about the boat. My pen froze above the paper.
What do you mean?
When I was at DMV, the clerk recognized the name Les St. Pierre from a few weeks ago. It's an unusual name. He commented that Les must be in a lot of trouble.
Why's that?
Seems I was the second person from the state attorney that month looking through his records.
Chapter 34. My mother was squatting in her neighbor's backyard, painting faux wisteria vines on a pine fence. To get to her, I had to step carefully in my dress shoes through a minefield of pie tins filled with various colors. She was wearing purple overalls and a fuchsia Night in Old San Antonio t-shirt, both speckled with acrylic. The air was warm and stagnant with fumes, and Mother was sweating almost as much as the open Pecan Street ale bottle on the stepping stone next to her. She greeted me without looking up. She swirled her brush to form a cluster of pale purple petals. There was a fingerprint, the exact same color on the side of her nose.
You know they sell plants now, I said. You can just buy them in stores.
Mother suppressed a giggle. I think that was my first indication maybe she'd been sitting in the heat and the paint fumes too long.
It's trompe l'oeil, Jackson. Then she lowered her voice. The Endermans are paying me.
I looked back at the Enderman's house. Mr. Enderman, a scruffy, retired newspaper man, was sitting at his typewriter at the dining room table. He was trying hard to look busy, but he kept sneaking sideways glances at us through the picture window. He was frowning, like the view hadn't improved since I'd arrived.
I won't tell, I promised.
Mother finished her petals and looked up at me. She did a double take.
Well, she raised her eyebrows. I'm sorry, I thought you were my son.
Mother,
no, you look wonderful, dear. What happened to your chin?
It's a bruise. She hesitated. She had noticed something else, too. That pheromonal afterglow that only mothers and girlfriends can detect. That aura which told her I had been up to something the night before. Whatever conclusions she came to, she kept to herself. She looked down at my ensemble while she stirred her brush through a pie tin.
I don't know if I'd have chosen the brown tie, but it's nice. I suppose conservative is best for an interview.
A woman in purple overalls is giving me fashion tips, she smiled.
I'm very proud of you. Would you like to take a medicine pouch for luck?
Actually, I was hoping to borrow the Audi. Mother tightened her lips. She reached past me for her beer bottle. I stepped back so she wouldn't get paint on my black slacks. After she took a sip of Pecan Street ale, she looked up and down the fence at her work so far.
Mr. Enderman wants grapevines along the top, she mused. I think that's too much with the wisteria, don't you?
I thought about it. You get paid per plant? She sighed.
Artistic question. I shouldn't have asked you. I hope you want the Audi just to drive to UTSA.
I gave her my best innocent look.
No, I have some work to do afterward. It would be better if I didn't use my own car for it. Some work, she repeated. Dear, the last time you borrowed my car for some work.
I know. I'll pay you back for any repairs.
That's not really the point, Jackson.
Can I trade cars with you or not, Mother? She put down her paintbrush, then wiped her hands on a rag. She pulled her keychain out of her bib pocket with two fingers.
My hands are sticky.
I took the key off the chain. Thanks.
Mother leaned in close to the fence and traced out a new curl in her vine. Mr. Enderman kept typing in the dining room, looking out the window from time to time to see if I'd gone away yet.
So, Mother said, are you nervous?
I refocused on her. About the interview? She nodded. No sweat, I said. Sitting around with a bunch of professors won't be the worst thing that's happened to me this week. Mother smiled knowingly.
Don't worry, you'll do fine.
She looked at my face again. For a minute I thought she might bring out a Kleenex, dab it on her tongue, and wipe my cheeks like she used to do when I was 5.
I hope we'll see you tomorrow.
You having your traditional costume party? I thought after all these years that I could keep the resentment out of my voice. I'm not sure I managed. She nodded.
It doesn't mean we can't make it a double celebration, Jackson.
I'll do my best.
You'll come, she insisted.
When I left, she was still deliberating whether or not to go with the grapevines. The neighborhood private security guy cruised past the front yard as I was opening my mother's white Audi sedan. He saw my dress clothes, and for the first time in 2 years, he didn't slow down or look at me suspiciously. There was an Indian medicine pouch waiting for me on Mother's dashboard. Chapter 35.
I think that went just fine, David Mitchell told me. Come in, come in. His office was on the 3rd floor of the Humanities and Social Sciences building, just down the hall from the interview room. On the office door was a Peanuts cartoon of Lucy in the psychiatrist's booth, with a little Doctor is in sign. Professor Mitchell, a man on the cutting edge of humor. His workspace was messy but cozy, filled with crammed bookshelves and dented filing cabinets and dying potted plants. There was a Macintosh computer set up as big as a Hyundai against the back wall. A poster for the Houston Renaissance Festival above that. More Lucy and Linus cartoons were scotch-taped around the room like hastily applied band-aids. Mitchell offered me a seat and a Diet Pepsi from his private stash. I accepted the seat.
Well, he said, now that we've grilled you, perhaps you have some questions of your own.
He nodded his head encouragingly. He'd done that all the way through the formal interview while his 3 colleagues, 2 elderly Anglo men and 1 Latino, stared at me and frowned and asked me over and over again what exactly I'd been doing since my postgraduate work. When they'd shaken my hand at the end of the hour, they'd all looked worried, like they should have worn surgical gloves. Maybe Mother was right. Maybe the brown tie had been a bad choice. I asked Mitchell some questions. Mitchell nodded his head a lot. He had silver hair and silver sideburns that were trimmed into the shape of fins from a 1950s automobile. His features were pinched and angular, and his eyes were beady, like a weasel's. A nice weasel. A good old weasel. Mitchell gave me some background on the teaching position that had opened up in the department. Apparently, old Dr. Hamer, who, as far as anyone could remember, had been teaching medieval literature since it was titled Contemporary Authors, was finally retiring, midterm. Last week, in fact. His 2 teaching assistants had resigned in protest, leaving Hamer's classes in the hands of other TAs and a few American lit professors who probably thought Marie de France was some kind of bicycle race.
Medieval just isn't a very popular field, Mitchell told me. Usually we'd have plenty of lecturers waiting to fill the position in an emergency, but
why did Hamer leave?
Mitchell shook his head. He opposed the establishment of more separate ethnic studies programs, said it was fragmenting, that the curriculum should have 1 inclusive canon.
Oops.
Mitchell looked grave. He had good intentions. The fact is, he said what was on a lot of our minds, but his vote was the only open dissent in the faculty senate. Word got out to the students, boycotts started, protests on the patio, signs that read racist, not the sort of public relations the provost wanted.
So why me? You don't need another white guy.
Mitchell stared at me like I just made an inside joke. Of course, the committee would prefer someone of diverse gender and ethnicity, I think is the going term. But...
He shook his head, letting a little more distaste show.
I'll have to speak with Dr. Gutierrez about that in the committee meeting, I'm sure. But let's talk about qualifications, son. We need someone who knows the field, someone with a good background, who can relate to the students, someone young, a teacher, more than a publisher. Technically, it would only be for the rest of the year, a visiting assistant professor's position, until a more extensive hiring search can be conducted. But still, once you're in, once you make connections on the faculty...
He nodded more encouragement, letting me get the picture. I got it. We talked a little more about the interview process, about when I might come back to teach a demo class if the committee decided to go the next step. I wasn't holding my breath for that, but I said I could stay available. Mitchell nodded, content. He opened the folder I'd given him and ran down my credentials and training from Berkeley. He started shaking his head and smiling.
You're bilingual.
Spanish and English, Middle English, some classical Spanish and Latin. Enough Anglo-Norman to get the dirty jokes and the fablios. He whistled silently and closed the folder.
You completed a 5-year program in 3 years. These letters of recommendation are extremely strong. How is it, after all that, you got into...
He looked for a polite word. Thug work, I offered. He chuckled.
Let's go with investigations.
Just luck, and the fact that the only job I could get with my PhD at the time was tending a bar on Telegraph Avenue, and the fact that a friend of mine introduced me to someone, a criminal lawyer who sort of took me in. Maya Lee probably would have laughed at that. Took me in was a nice euphemism for teaching somebody to break a window the right way, disarm a security system, do a skip trace, blackmail somebody with photos to keep a civil case from going to trial. Maya's associates at Terrence and Goldman had frowned on her methods until Maya made junior partner. Mitchell was looking at me, still smiling, but with a little more wistfulness in his expression.
And the fact your father was a lawman... he suggested. I suspect your mother is right. That had a lot to do with your career getting sidetracked.
I didn't answer.
Sidetracked? So, why would you go back to academia now? He asked.
I think I told him something about wanting an intellectual challenge and applying real-world experience to the classroom, blah, blah, blah. My mind was pretty well disconnected with my spiel by the time someone knocked on the door. Mitchell excused himself. He went into the hall and mumbled briefly with one of the other members of the hiring committee. He came back in and sat down. He kept his face impassive.
That didn't take long, he said.
I got ready to leave, to tell him thanks anyway. Mitchell broke into a grin.
They'd like to see a demo next week. Dr. Gutierrez said you're the most refreshing candidate he's interviewed in a long time.
When I left Mitchell's office, I had a little slip of paper confirming my demo lesson to the medieval undergrad seminar on Monday. I also had a dazed, sticky feeling, like somebody had already started wallpapering me with Peanuts cartoons and scotch tape. Chapter 36. A red Mazda Miata was parked in front of 90 Queen Anne Street, with its right tires over the curb. When I walked around to my side of the house, Allison St. Pierre came out my front door and said,
"Hi."
She was wearing white Reeboks, a pleated white skirt, and a white tank top that wasn't lining up with her bra straps very well. A terry cloth sweatband pushed her hair into bangs. Her smile was alcohol-fortified, tennis lesson day at the country club. She was holding 2 shiner box. One bottle was almost empty, the other she gave to me.
"Damnedest thing," she said.
She leaned sideways in the doorway, so I could pass if I wanted to do the mumbo with her. I stayed on the porch.
"Let me guess, my landlord let you in."
She smiled wider.
"Sweet old fart.
He picked up that envelope on the counter and asked me if I knew anything about this month's rent.
Yeah, Gary has a thing for blondes. Rent money and blondes. Maybe if I brought over more blondes, he'd ask less often about the rent.
Allison raised her eyebrows.
Worth a try.
Then she turned inside like her back was hinged to the door jamb. I almost thought she was going to fall into the living room, but at the last minute she put her foot out and walked in. She said, "Whoo!" I drank some of my Shinerbach before following her inside. Allison had taken Julie Kearns out of the cassette deck and put in my Johnny Johnson. She'd pulled an old Texas Monthly off the windowsill and left it open on the coffee table. The ironing board was down and the phone had been pulled out from behind it. Allison sat on the kitchen counter stool and spread her arms along the formica.
"Somebody named Carol called. I told her you weren't here."
"Carol Lane," I corrected.
"That's just great. Thanks."
She shrugged, happy to help. I looked for Robert Johnson, but he'd buried himself deep, maybe under the laundry, maybe in the pantry. Unlike my landlord, Robert Johnson didn't go much for blondes.
"You send Sheckley a get-well card yet?" I asked.
Allison had a happy drunk going that was about as thick as battleship skin. My question pinged against her, a small annoyance, but not nearly enough to make her change course.
"One of his lawyers left me a message this morning, something about the medical bills."
She was turning the tip of her right sneaker in time to the music, back, forth, back, forth. I waited.
"You're in my apartment for a good reason, I'm sure. Mind telling me what it is?"
Allison appraised me while she bobbed her head, starting at my feet and working her way up. When she got to my eyes, she locked on and smiled approvingly.
"You look good. You should dress like that more often."
I shook my head. This outfit reminds me of too many funerals.
"That's where you were this morning?"
"Close enough. Why are you here?" Allison lifted her fingers off the counter.
"You were listed in the book. I felt bad about you getting hit last night."
"You felt bad," she grinned.
"I'm not that terrible, sweetie. You don't know me well enough."
"The guys who know you well enough seem to get flesh wounds."
"Like I said, Trace, I grew up with four brothers.
How many of them made it to adulthood?" Her eyes sparkled. No making her mad today.
"Maybe I was just curious. Miranda's dad called me this morning. He wanted to know if Miranda was with me last night."
"Yeah?" She gave me a smirk.
"Yeah. Seems she disappeared last night after the party. So did you, for that matter."
She waited for information. Fortunately for me, the phone rang. Allison offered to get it. I told her thanks anyway. I moved the phone to the bathroom doorway, which was as far as it would stretch, then picked up the receiver.
Irene Manos said, "R-I-A-A."
"Is that Greek?" The next thing she said was Greek, and unflattering.
"No, honey, I'm telling you something you never got from me. Recording Industry Association of America. When it comes to enforcing copyright laws in the music industry, they're it. They've got a branch office in Houston. For all of South Texas, they contract through Samuel Barrera."
I looked across the room at Allison. She smiled at me pleasantly, still moving her feet to the Johnny Johnson.
"That's great," I told Irania.
"I'm glad it was nothing serious." Irania hesitated.
"You got visitors?"
"Uh-huh."
"Just listen, then. Sheckley's been in court half a dozen times the last few years, sued by big-name artists who have appeared at his place. They all claim he's taped their shows for syndication and given them no rights to anything, no percentage."
"I've heard about that."
"They also claim bootleg CDs of their shows have been turning up all over Europe. Excellent quality recordings made at first-rate facilities. My friends tell me it's pretty common knowledge Sheckley is the one making the tapes, getting a little extra money out of them.
He speaks German, goes over to Germany frequently, probably uses the trips to strike some deals, distribute his masters, but nobody can prove it. Since the shows are taped for syndication, they could have been copied and distributed at any radio station in the country by anybody with the right equipment. I smiled at Allison. I mouthed the words, sick friend.
Doesn't sound like anything that would kill you, just a minor annoyance.
Urania was silent. It doesn't sound like anything to get killed over, honey. You're right. Then again, how much money are we talking about? What kind of guy is Mr. Sheckley? You got a sense for that?
I'm afraid I might. Why haven't they caught this before?
I hear Sheckley keeps things pretty modest, doesn't import the music back into the U.S., which would make it more profitable, but 10 times easier to bust. He sticks to the European market, only live tapes, makes him a low-priority target.
Got it. And, honey, you heard nothing from me.
Room 12, all right. If you can use this to squeeze Barrera's balls a little bit,
I'll do that. Same to you.
I hung up. Allison looked at me and said,
"Good prognosis."
"You mind if I change clothes?" She pursed her lips and nodded.
"Go ahead."
I pulled a T-shirt and jeans out of the closet and went into the bathroom. Robert Johnson peeped out the side of the shower curtain.
"Not yet," I told him.
His head disappeared back into the bathtub. I'd just taken off the dress shirt and was pulling the sleeves right side out when Allison came in and poked her finger in my back, touching the scar above my kidney. It took great effort to control my backward elbow strike reflex.
"What's this?" she asked.
"You mind not doing that?" She acted like she hadn't heard. She poked the scar again, like the puffiness of the skin fascinated her. Her breath dragged across my shoulder like the edge of a washcloth.
"Bullet hole?"
I turned to face her, but there wasn't much place to back up unless I sat in the sink. "Sword tip. My Sifu got a little excited one time."
"Sifu?"
"Teacher, the guy who trained me in Taiji." She laughed.
"Your own teacher stabbed you? He must not be very good."
"He's very good." The problem was he thought I was good, too.
"Got another scar. That one's longer."
She was looking at my chest now, where a hash dealer had stabbed me with a Balinese knife in San Francisco's Tenderloin District. I put on my T-shirt. Allison pouted.
"Show's over."
I waved her out and closed the bathroom door in her face. She was still smiling when I did it. Robert Johnson stared at me as I put on the jeans. He looked about as amused as I was.
"Maybe if we rush her," I suggested, "a two-flank approach."
His head disappeared again. So much for backup. When I came into the living room, Allison had opened another beer and relocated to the futon.
"This reminds me of my old place in Nashville," she said, studying the water-stained plaster on the ceiling.
"God, that was bad."
"Thanks." She looked at me, puzzled.
"I just meant it's small. I was living on nothing for a while. Makes me kind of nostalgic, you know?"
"The good old days," I said, "before you married money." She drank some beer.
"Don't knock it, Trace. You know what the joke was in Foul Furious?"
"Foul Furious, that's where you're from?" She nodded sourly.
"We joke that you only go to college for an MRS.
She tapped her wedding ring with her thumb.
"I bypassed the degree plan."
She closed all 10 fingers around the beer bottle and kicked her feet up on the futon. I stared at the beer, wondering how many it would take for me to catch up with her.
"When I was 18, I was working during the summer as a secretary at Al Garland's auto dealership."
She looked at me meaningfully, like I should know Al Garland, obviously a big wig in Foul Furious. I shook my head. She looked disappointed.
"I was trying to sing at a few clubs in Corpus Christi on the weekends. Next thing I know, Al was telling me he was going to leave his wife for me, telling me he would finance my music career. We started taking weekend trips to Nashville so he could show me how rich and important he was.
He must have sunk 10,000 into the wallet, doctors.
Wallet doctors?
She grinned.
The guys in Nashville that smell small-town money a mile off. They promised Al all kinds of stuff for me. Recordings, promotion, connections. Nothing ever happened except I showed Al how grateful I was. A lot. I thought it was love for a while. Eventually he decided I'd become too expansive, or maybe his wife found out. I never knew which. I got left in Nashville with about $50 in cash and some really nice negligees. Stupid, huh?
I didn't say anything. Allison drank more beer.
You know the bad part? I finally got up the courage to tell somebody in Nashville that story, and it was Les St. Pierre. He just laughed. It happens 100 times every month, he told me, the exact same way. The big trauma of my life was just another statistic. Then Les told me he could make it right, and I got suckered again. I was a slow learner.
You don't have to tell me any of this, she shrugged.
I don't care.
She sounded like she'd said it so many times she could almost believe it.
What happened with the agency? I asked. Why did Les decide to push you out of the business?
Allison shrugged. Les didn't want somebody bringing him back to Earth when he went really far out with an idea. He didn't know when to stop. Most of the time, it turned out well for him that way. Not always.
Such as?
She shook her head noncommittal.
It doesn't really matter. Not now.
And if he doesn't come back?
I'll get the agency.
You sound sure. You think you can keep it afloat without him?
I know, Les's reputation. Sure, it'll be tough. But that's assuming I keep the agency. The name is worth money. I can sell it to all kinds of competitors in Nashville. There are also contracts in place for publishing rights on some hits that are still bringing in money. Les wasn't stupid.
Sounds like you've been looking into it. Allison shrugged, slight smile.
Wouldn't you?
You must have run down his assets, then.
I've got a pretty good idea.
You know anything about a cabin on Medina Lake? Allison's face got almost sober. She stared at me blankly. I told her about the probate settlement from Les's parents' property.
First I've heard about it.
But there was something else going on in her head. Like something that had been bothering her slightly for a long time was now coming to the forefront. I looked at her, silently asking her to tell me about it. She wavered, then looked away.
You have a plan, sweetie?
I thought I'd head out there, check things out. I regretted my answer as soon as I said it. Allison tottered to her feet, held up her beer to check how much was left, then smiled at me.
You'd better drive. I'll navigate.
Then she began that job by trying to locate the front door. Chapter 37. Allison was quiet for the first half of the trip. She'd complained bitterly before we left about me making her a thermos of coffee rather than tequila, then making her change clothes into something more utilitarian. I'd found a pair of Carolanes drawstring Banana Republics and a crew-neck pullover in the back of the closet. They fit Allison well. Once we got going, she curled into the passenger seat of my mother's Audi with her knees on the dash and her face behind the coffee mug and a pair of my mother's purple sunglasses she'd pulled out of the glove compartment. For a while, she made occasional, sounds, and I thought she was going to be ill. But once we got out of the city, she began to perk up. She even decided to come with me into the tax assessor's office when we got to Wilming. Wilming was a small county seat consisting of an American Legion hall and a Dairy Queen and not much else. The assessor's office was open Saturday because it was also the post office and the grocery store. After successfully scoring the deed and the last 5 years of tax records on Les's property, I had to grudgingly admit that having the subject's wife with me, the subject's pretty blonde wife, had helped expedite matters somewhat. When we got back in the car, Allison poured herself more coffee and said,
Gah!
It's just strong, I said. You're not used to Pete's. She shuddered.
Is this like Starbucks or something?
Pete's is to Starbucks what Plato is to Socrates. You'll appreciate it in time. Allison stared at me for about half a mile, then decided to turn her attention back to the tax assessor's documents and the coffee. She flipped through the paperwork on Les's cabin.
Bastard!
2 years ago, he changed the billing for the tax statements so they wouldn't come to the house, exactly when we got married. He wanted a place you didn't know about. He might have already been thinking about getting away someday, leaving himself an exit route. She made a small, incredulous laugh.
What's this billing address in Austin? A girlfriend?
Probably a mail drop. A girlfriend would be too risky.
Bastard. You think you can find this place?
I shook my head. Don't know. We had the exact address for the cabin, but that didn't mean much at the lake. Most people had their address registered as a mailbox along the main highway, and there would be hundreds of those, all plain silver, many of them with incomplete or weathered-down numbers. Even if we found the right box, it wouldn't necessarily be near the cabin. Most likely, that would be a mile or two down some unnamed gravel road, the turnoff marked only by wooden boards displaying the last names of some of the families that lived that way. Often, there was no sign at all, no way to find someone out here unless you had word-of-mouth instructions. If you could avoid the notice of the locals, Medina Lake wasn't a bad place for a missing person to hide out. We passed Woman Hollow Creek, wended our way through some more hills, down Highway 16. The ratio of RVs to cars began to climb. Allison examined my mother's medicine pouch on the rearview mirror, letting the beads and feathers slip through her fingers.
So how do you know Milo, anyway? You two don't seem, I don't know, you're like the odd couple or something.
You know that scar on my chest? Allison hesitated.
You're kidding.
Milo didn't do it. He had this idea. He thought I'd make a good private detective. The road was too twisty for me to look at Allison's face, but she stayed quiet for another mile or so. The purple sunglasses turned toward me. I missed the noise and the wind and the rattling of the VW. In my mother's Audi, the quiet spaces were way too quiet. Finally, Allison laced her fingers together and stretched her arms.
Okay, so what happened?
Milo was assistant counsel for defense on this homicide case. His first big job with Terrence and Goldman in San Francisco. He wanted someone who could track down a witness, a drug dealer, who'd seen the murder. Milo thought I could do it. He thought he'd really impress his boss that way.
And you found the guy?
Oh, yeah, I found him. I spent a few days in San Francisco General afterward.
Milo's boss was impressed?
With Milo, no. With me, yes. Once I got out of intensive care. Allison laughed.
He gave you a job?
She offered to train me, yes. She fired Milo.
That's even better. And a woman, too.
Most definitely a woman. Allison opened her mouth, then began to nod.
Aha! Milo wanted to impress...
It wasn't just professional.
But you and her...
Yeah. Allison grinned. She nudged my arm.
I do believe the P.I. is blushing.
Nonsense. She laughed, then uncapped the thermos and poured herself another cup of Pete's.
This stuff is beginning to taste better.
We skirted the lake for over a mile before we actually saw it. The hills and the cedars obscured the view most of the way around. The waterline was so far down that the clay and limestone shore looked like a beige bathtub ring between the water and the trees. Medina wasn't a lake you could get your bearings on very easily. The water snaked around, following the course of the original river that was dammed to make the lake, etching out coves and dead ends, each outlet and inlet looking pretty much like all the others. We might have been searching for Les's cabin the rest of the week if an old friend hadn't helped us out. About a mile past the Highway 37 cutoff, A black Ford Festiva was pulled off on the right side of the road, opposite the lake. The driver's side window was open, and a red-headed orangutan-looking guy was behind the wheel, reading a newspaper. I drove a quarter mile up the road and then U-ed around. I waited for a semi to rumble by and then pulled in behind it, following close.
"What are we doing?"
Allison asked. "Keep looking straight ahead." On my second pass, the redhead in the Festiva still didn't pay me any attention, but it was definitely Elgin. He had his head firmly buried in the sports page. Advanced surveillance methods. He'd probably figure out to poke eye holes in the paper pretty soon. I quickly scanned the area he was staking out. There were no side roads in view. There were no mailboxes. It was just a curve of highway around a hill. On the lakeside, the road fell away in a steep, heavily wooded slope, so you couldn't really see what was down toward the water. But there were some power lines angling in. That meant at least one cabin and only one way to get down there. Past Elgin. "Elgin without Frank," I said. "Not smart." Allison looked behind us.
"What are you talking about?"
I told her about my encounter the night before with Elgin and Frank on the side of the highway, how they'd introduced my face to the asphalt and offered me a very nice throw-down gun. I told her they were probably sheriff deputies, buddies of Tilden Sheckley.
"What shits?" she said. "And they're watching Les's place?"
"One of them, at least."
"So we're going to go back and whack them on the head or something, right? Time up?"
I chanced a look sideways to see if she was kidding. I couldn't tell.
"Whack him on the head? Hey, I've got Mace, too. Let's go."
After her performance with Sheckley the previous evening, I thought it prudent not to deride her abilities as a head whacker. I said, "Let's keep that as a backup plan. Get a 50 out of my backpack." We kept driving, going back as far as Turk's Ice House. After 5 minutes of chit-chat with Eustace, the blue-haired store clerk in the flashy satin shirt, we came to an agreement that the cove we wanted was Maple End, and no, Eustace didn't recognize Les from his picture, and no, Allison hadn't gone to high school with Eustace's daughter. Despite the last disappointment, Eustace agreed to introduce us to Bip, who agreed to loan us his outboard fishing boat for $50. Bip and his boat were both large grayish wedges, dented up and grungy, and both smelled like live bait. Bip kept grinning at Allison and saying, "Whoa," every time he looked away from her. I tried to give him warning looks to let him know he was putting himself in mortal peril, but Bip paid no attention. We started the outboard with some effort and pulled away from the dock at Turk's. The cove widened into the main spine of the lake. A half mile away, on the far shore, the hills were dotted with cabins and radio towers. Occasionally, a motorboat would zip by a few hundred yards away. A minute or so afterward, we'd find ourselves bobbing up and down as we cut through the wake. By the time we turned the boat toward the mouth of Maple End Cove, we had lake water up to our ankles, and I'd had to move my backpack off the floor and into my lap. Bip had assured us those little holes in the boat would be no problem. Allison took off her shoes and was about to dangle her footsies over the side when I said, "I wouldn't do that." She frowned. In the afternoon sun, the purple glasses cast long red reflections down her cheeks.
"What? They're already wet."
"It's not the water. It's the moccasins." I pointed ahead to a spot where the water was rippling a little bit more aggressively than the normal dips and swells. Allison brought her feet back in. We passed the floating nest. A dozen or so green and silver whips were twisting into sailor's knots just below the surface. Allison whistled softly.
"Only snakes we had in Falfurious got made into belts. Hope these guys understand if the boat sinks next to them."
"Me too. Last year, a water skier took a spill into one of those nests. She died instantly." Allison put her feet up on my bench, one on either side of my legs. Her toenails were painted red. Her pants legs were rolled halfway up her tanned calves and fit tight that way, not loose as they would have on Caroline. She rested her elbow on her knee and cupped her hand on her chin and blinked her eyes at me.
"I believe you made that up, Mr. Navarre."
I shrugged, tried not to smile. We puttered along past the snakes. The southern tip of Maple End Cove, sure enough, had a huge maple tree jutting from the top of the ridge. Maples are pretty rare in Texas, but this one apparently hadn't heard the news that it wasn't supposed to thrive. It was at least 30 feet tall and blazing with fall colors. The rocky ground around it was littered with burnt orange and apple yellow. At the waterline below, several women were sunbathing on an old floating pontoon dock. There were stairs cut into the rock leading down to the dock, but they stopped a good 20 feet above where the waterline used to be. The cove narrowed quickly as our boat puttered into it. After one curve, the banks on either side were no more than 20 yards apart. The water this far back was murky green and smelled of stagnation, scum, and leaking septic material and dead fish. The shoreline on the right was fairly steep and thick with cedars and live oaks, all the branches overgrown with spiky Spanish moss. I could glimpse the tops of semis or RVs speeding along the highway above where Elgin was parked. There were two cabins, both on that side of the cove. The one farther down was a well-kept, white-shingled house set almost at the top of the ridge. At the water level was a floating dock, and above that a small patch of lawn grass. A hand-painted wooden sign, meant to be read from the water, proudly announced, "The Heidelmans," with daisies and frogs all around the letters. There was a small army of plastic waterfowl with wind propellers for wings surrounding the sign and a flagstone path up to the house. The windows were all shuttered, and no lights were on. A half-acre closer to us was a military-style Quonset hut that jutted out of the slope about halfway between the water and the highway. It had a wooden deck facing the water. The front wall was painted chocolate brown with a screen door and two windows covered in yellow curtains. The hut's shell was an arc of corrugated aluminum as dull as the inside of a food can. There was a metal pipe chimney in the back.
"My husband," Allison sighed. "Wonder if I can figure out which one of these is his."
I cut the boat's engine and drifted into the tall weeds by the shore below the Quonset hut. The boat ground against the rocks as it came to a stop. There was a dock, sort of. The cement pylons were still there and a few boards not yet rotted to splinters. I wasn't sure I wanted to trust them with my weight. 10 feet to the left of the dock, there was a sunken boat sticking its prow out of the water. The remnants of Bip's last customer, maybe. I sloshed and slipped my way onto dry land. Allison stayed right behind me. I looked up at the dark windows and the closed door of the Quonset hut. If Elgin was smart, if he was keeping watch because he thought Les might show up here, he'd have his partner, Frank, somewhere down here. Maybe at the Heidelmans, or even inside Les's cabin. Of course, if Elgin was smart, he wouldn't have been so damn easy to spot on the highway. I figured we had a fighting chance. We climbed what passed for steps, old boards hammered perpendicularly into the clay of the hill. The stairs to the deck were on the side of the cabin. Nobody on the highway could have seen us from there. Nobody jumped out of the woods in commando gear. We made plenty of creaks and cracks getting to the front door. If anybody was inside, they sure as hell know we were coming. The door was padlocked, one of those loops slotted through a metal hinge. Dumb. I got Allison to hand me a Phillips head out of my backpack and removed the base of the hinge in less than a minute. We could have gone through the window pretty easily, too, but I wasn't ready to break glass just yet. We went inside the hut. Allison said, "Yuck!" It was dark. It smelled like rotten food and sour laundry. In the light of my pencil flashlight, it was difficult to piece together exactly what we were seeing, what happened here. There was an unmade single bed against the left wall, a portable stereo against the right, littered all around with CDs and cassettes. The CD carriage was sticking out, the drink holder, as my brother Garrett called it. The floor was covered in grass mat that was starting to tear into separate squares. The curved roof was covered with black cloth that just made the space seem more claustrophobic. In the back was a kitchenette and a phone, and one shuttered window and a tiny walled-in area that must have been the bathroom. When our eyes adjusted to the dark, Allison went into the kitchen and lifted a pan of half-scrambled eggs from the electric grill. They were rubberized in places, crystallized in others.
2 eggs for breakfast, Allison said. Every day, no exceptions.
He left halfway through making those, I said. What do you think, about 2 or 3 days ago? Allison shuddered, put the pan down.
Something like that. So the bastard's alive.
She sounded less than thrilled. She gave me a tentative smile.
I guess I figured that. It's just...
She hooked her thumbs in her borrowed Banana Republics, looked around at her feet where men's clothes were strewn around as if somebody had walked through a laundry pile. Then she kicked one of Les's shirts with a vengeance. I went into the bathroom. A man's toiletry bag was in the sink, next to a propane-powered destroylet with directions on the lid about how to avoid a house fire when you flushed. I got out my Polaroid and took a picture of the toilet. Nobody would believe me about it otherwise. Then I took some pictures of the rest of the cabin. The eggs, the laundry, the scattered CDs. I went to the kitchen counter and picked up the phone. The line was active. I set the switch from touch tone to pulse and pressed redial. I was pretty sure I got the number on the first listen, but I hung up before it rang, then tried it again. I wrote the number on my hand and let the phone ring. No answer on 10, no answering machine. Allison said,
Trace.
I turned. She was looking at me reproachfully, holding the frying pan with the eggs. As quietly as possible, she said,
Well, this... Or the mace?
What? Then I heard the creaking from outside, like someone trying to climb the old porch steps with at least some semblance of stealth. Chapter 38. A shadow moved across the yellow curtain into the doorway and became Frank the Bubba, my courteous shakedown deputy from the night before. He scowled and smushed his nose against the screen door, trying to see into the interior gloom. He was wearing jeans and an orange Hawaiian shirt, more advanced surveillance techniques. I looked at Allison.
You're a lot of fun, but right now I want you to put down the frying pan, okay?
Are you crazy?
Put it down.
Frank's eyes adjusted to the dark. He focused on me. I smiled and waved. He looked at Allison. Slowly, she lowered the pan and waved, too.
If we had a gun, she speculated quietly, we could have shot him 5 or 6 times by now.
Shut up, I told her. Please.
Frank opened the door and came inside. His face was lye-scrubbed red, and his eyes were bleary. His blonde mustache whiskers spiked at weird angles. He looked groggy and irritated, but not particularly surprised.
That's right, he said. You two really need to be here.
The walkie-talkie in his belt made a click, then a metallic crackling sound. He kept his eyes on me while he picked it up.
Never mind, Garwood. False alarm.
The garbled response sounded vaguely like Elgin's voice. I couldn't make out what he said, but apparently Frank could.
Yeah, he said. It was nothing.
Frank turned the volume knob down to 0. False alarm? I asked. Frank scanned the room, tapping the walkie-talkie against his thigh.
Elgin has some ideas what he might do if he ever sees you again. I don't want him to get too excited.
Frank looked around for a place to sit, opted for the bed. He sank into the foam mattress, hesitated, then crossed his legs and began to pry off his left boot.
"Got to excuse me," he grumbled. "Feet are killing me."
Allison said, "You want us to rub them for you?" She was leaning against the kitchen counter, head on her hand like she was bored. She glanced at me and said, "This guy managed to get you on the pavement?" Frank's ears turned the same color orange as his Hawaiian shirt. He raised his eyebrows at me.
"New woman?"
Allison St. Pierre. She's charming, really. The name registered. Maybe the reputation, too. Frank gave me a weary look of condolence. He switched legs and tugged off the other boot. His socks were two slightly different shades of blue.
"I didn't like what happened last night, Mr. Navarre. I didn't like it worth a damn."
"Try being the one with your nose in the gravel." A smile flickered underneath the mustache.
"You don't get what I'm saying. People bother Mr. Sheckley, I got no problem pushing them around a little. That's not my beef."
"Reassuring." Allison sighed. She fiddled wistfully with the mace on her keychain, picking at the little plastic tab.
"Sheck takes care of his people," Frank continued. "It's a close-knit county out here. P.I.s come around all year long, sticking their noses into the paintbrush's business, looking for paternity suits, blackmail photos, you name it. I don't have any problem dissuading them."
"Planting guns in their cars," I said. Frank sat quiet for a long time, then apparently decided something. He sat forward, reached into his wallet and pulled out a photograph.
"Look at this."
I took the photo. It showed Frank in white shorts and a different Hawaiian shirt, his arm around a similarly dressed plump blonde woman. The woman was holding a white bundle that was either the world's largest Q-tip pad or a well-swaddled baby.
"Got a family now," he said.
I smiled politely. I handed the photo to Allison, who gave it the same bored once-over she'd given Frank.
"That means something to me," Frank insisted. "Gets me thinking in a different way. Taking care of friends, looking after people that have been good to the department, that's one thing. But throwdowns with a lady in the car."
"Yeah," I agreed. "You really know how to draw the moral line." He spread his hands.
"All right. Maybe you don't want to hear it. I just wanted you to know..."
"That your partner didn't share his plans with you," I supplied. "Doesn't make me feel any better." Frank stared